When you can give a lot of things to a lot of people at once, you avoid lines. It's part of the beauty of broadcasting. Everyone gets the same thing at the same time. But not everything can be cast broadly. Things like concert seats and hamburgers and driver's licenses. For those things, we often have to wait in line. Our first guest today is fascinated by lines, enough to write a book about them. David Andrews wrote, Why Does the Other Line Always Move Faster? The Myths and Misery, Secrets and Psychology of Waiting in Line. David Andrews grew up in Washington State and in Romania, where he says lines tend to be impossibly long. He now lives in Minnesota. David once served as a Russian linguist in the U.S. Navy. David Andrews, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And I understand it was in Navy training that you first thought about lines or started thinking deeply about them anyway.
Well, you know, the big surprise when I was in the military going through boot camp and you go in, you're expecting this action-packed experience. And the big surprise for me was you spend most of the day just waiting for things, just staring at the back of the head of the person in front of you because you're not allowed to speak, and it gives you a lot of time to dwell upon what it is you're actually doing while standing in line.
The lessons of the universe become a lot clearer when you're staring at the back of somebody else's head, huh?
Yeah, kind of has this, like, the boredom becomes super focused, and you feel it like a mild ache all over at that point.
So in the military, David, is it just about trying to give limited resources out to a large number of people at one time, or is it also about enforcing discipline or some combination thereof?
Some combination thereof, certainly. I mean, you know, the unofficial motto of the U.S. military is hurry up and wait. And there's definitely a great deal of learning to be patient while in the military. Things get decided in a very slow fashion. So you're sure to wait almost wherever you go within the military system. But it is also about, yes, instilling discipline, knowing it's, you know, the first thing they train you in boot camp is how to wait in line so that you always know what you're supposed to be doing in a given situation. And it's always much simpler than you think it will be, as in just get behind that guy and follow him to the end of the line.
Well, and obviously we do a lot of lining up outside of the military, and we seem to be a fairly docile people. I mean, even if you don't have those little velvet ropes and stuff around, we tend to be very, you know, oh, don't you first, no, you first, at the coffee counter and at the bank and all the places like that. Is this universal, or are Americans a little unusual in our willingness to queue up?
Well, we're not unique in the sense that, you know, people in Britain queue up a lot, famously, people in Japan. Different countries have different cultures of queuing. But what's interesting to me in researching this book is to find that line standing is not a universal cultural phenomenon. So another thing that drove me to research this book was experience going to Amman, Jordan, in the Middle East. And there was strikingly few lines for anything, and kind of raise the question, so if this is not a universal, then why did we implement line standing? Was this a given for all time, or did this come about due to, for instance, military-like disciplining?
And did you make some historical findings about when we began lining up?
Well, you know, one of the most remarkable discoveries to me was how recent a phenomenon it is. There's not even like a concept for it, for the queue, until about 1840, when great English author Thomas Carlyle was writing about the French Revolution and noticing that these people were standing what he called en queue, which means in tail, you know, because a line looks like a tail. And he has these rapturous words for this French practice because, you know, writing from London of the, you know, 1800s, very chaotic city and a lot of just crowds swelling to and fro. And here the French had this kind of system of order that was remarkable to Thomas Carlyle and for, you know, future visitors to Paris in later years. Leading until about the mid-1800s, you still have accounts of American travelers abroad. What a remarkable phenomenon the standing in line thing is. How quaint, how French.
Really, and so now we're the ones who stand in line and put our shoes and our belts in those buckets at the airport and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, and, you know, you see, you start seeing changes around the turn of the century, where, you know, between, say, 1850 and 1900, suddenly the line became ubiquitous, and you start having people complaining about standing in line and what it does to the human soul, to behave like a machine behaves.
David Andrews is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Why Does the Other Line Always Move Faster? You can join us on the exchange with your thoughts about being in lines, or you can hold off till our Vents Day segment, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So you actually have figured out that there are some differences in the way that cultures view lines, and we end up with the terms monochronic and polychronic, which I should point out, Microsoft Word really wants to change to monochromic.
Well, there's an extra part to that term, which is monochronic and low context and polychronic and high context cultures. And what that means is a monochronic, low context culture takes very few social cues into account for decision making. So the fact that we serve people first come, first serve, and that's the only distinction that we make when serving someone. Whereas in a polychronic, high-context culture, they might need to make lots more readings of people based on social cues. For instance, perhaps you let elder people go first, or you make some deference to class, or you have to understand the context by which decisions are made. And what this ends up doing is having an effect on our conception of time. Monochronic, we feel that time is the same for everyone. It's time in the West has become standardized thanks to, you know, needing to make train schedules, for instance. Where in polychronic societies, it's much more based in personal interactions, and the passage of time is based in, you know, oral storytelling traditions and whatnot. And so there's a different conception of, you know, this immutable concept of time.
Are there often then some class distinctions that have existed for a long time in the polychronic high context cultures?
Well, certainly it isn't. Like, I mean, every one of them is going to be different. But yeah, for instance, a lot of cultures respect elders and give lots of deference to elders because a lot of the cultural norms are passed down through elders. Or just bargaining, you know, or if you go to some bazaar, or, you know, a marketplace and you have people, you know, budging and hustling to the front, but there's a lot more that's going on than I, as a monochronic, low context thinker, am able to quite glean onto, at least without in-depth study of it.
All right, so there's certainly going to be some more physicality about that, which raises the question then. I mean, how else would you do it? We tend to live in fairly small communities in the region you're talking to now. Outside of Eugene, the largest city, there's, you know, not much in the way of lines. I mean, so in groups of two or three or more, is there any other way other than, well, you got here first, you should go?
Yeah, and, you know, this is the big distinction is between, right, urban culture and, out, you know, in the country where, you know, lines as a form starts in reaction to mass urbanization, where there's all these people from different parts of the world all moving into one place and not having, you know, set. Everybody comes from different cultural contexts, and so you need to kind of standardize different, you know, how we know how to behave when, say, a crowd forms. Happens in reaction to cities. If you're not in a city, that becomes less necessary, so that just because there's fewer people, you meet with less lines, and those lines tend to be more informal when they do exist.
We are talking about lines with David Andrews, who wrote a whole book on this called Why Does the Other Line Always Move Faster? The Myths and Misery, Secrets and Psychology of Waiting in Line. You can join the discussion either now or in our Vents Day segment in a few minutes. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So some big names. You had some already in Mr. Carlyle here, but how is Franz Kafka the patron saint of the queue?
Well, Franz Kafka, people know anything about him. His day job, besides being a prolific author, was working in a bureaucracy, basically, in what's now the Czech Republic. And he had intimate experience with, like, the workings of bureaucracy. And so often his novels, such as the one that I write most prominently about, which is The Castle, featured a lot of people trying to make headway within large bureaucracies and waiting to hear from some authority that never shows up. And it's these, you know, the protagonist of a Kafka novel never actually get to the end of a line, it seems like. They're always waiting, and the ending is always pushed off into the distant future. So it's kind of this Sisyphean sort of waiting that feels endless, and definitely has influenced a lot of thinking about lines in the 20th century, at least.
You mentioned that it was in the 19th century that we first started hearing about lines, and I just wonder if humans had to be directed or trained to get into them. I mean, it seems like in some cultures where they've been around for a while, it's because we get used to standing in lines as kids in school and everything, and in other cultures that's not so.
Well, certainly. You know, the fact that we have, you know, everybody goes to the public school system is one way that we enforce this cultural norm. You know, the fact that so many people have gone through the military, especially, you know, in the 20th century, so many people, you know, were drafted. So there's like direct ways that people have been trained, but there's also environmental cues. So you mentioned earlier the red velvet rope at the bank or the way, even the way that cities are designed. But if you go to like one of the old style European cities and the roads go this way and that way, and starting in the 19th century, we start getting grid systems that with sidewalks that separate people from the streets that keep people moving in a straight line. There's lots of ways that it's reinforced culturally. And then simply the other way it's reinforced is that when I see someone standing in line, I'm more likely to stand in line. So it's like socially reinforced. No one wants to go against the grain of the crowd.
It is interesting, you know, you go charging up to the ticket window, but you stop and you look around. It's like, is there a line here? Oh, there is. Okay. And you're the last person? Okay, good. You know, you always go through that little step of making sure you're not offending somebody else, unless you don't particularly care. But I think most of us do. You were talking about the changing in city designs, but architecture itself within those cities also changed. Tell us about Grand Central Terminal and its design from the early 1900s.
Well, so New York transportation authorities decided, you know, they wanted a building that reflected the best things about New York. They wanted a big, beautiful building. So they built this Grand Central Station that immediately was a failure. Because basically what it was just a big empty hall without any sort of visual cues about how to use this building, how to move through the building. And so you have like a kind of people trampled on their way to get onto a train. And there's no cue barriers or any sort of like ways of turning the kind of craziness of the crowd into some sort of ordered movement through this space. And so it was immediately deemed a failure despite its beauty. And so then they did a redesign, which was basically, yeah, it's filtering crowds. So you separate them out. So that one has to move behind another. They have different rampways and hallways. They also have separate waiting areas for immigrants. For instance, immigrants would have to go wait in a separate way because they couldn't count on the immigrant populations to know what the social cues of the space were. So the idea is to get everybody thinking of themselves as like a solitary person waiting behind the next solitary person rather than in this giant swelling crowd that causes so much chaos.
And Grand Central is still a thing of beauty 103 years after it opened as Grand Central Terminal with 42 tracks on two levels. I'm well familiar with it, so things move through there pretty well. Now, you also tell us, though, another history story here about the Piggly Wiggly in Memphis and how it looks to you when you look at that first supermarket in 1916.
Yeah, so the Piggly Wiggly, for people who don't know, was the first self-service grocery store. The first time people would walk in and pick up their own items off the shelf and take them to the cash register. And if you look at old pictures of the original Piggly Wiggly, what you won't see is these wide, you know, aisles of the Kroger's or whatever the large chain supermarkets are. What you have is a cramped little, basically, maze of shelves that everybody has to go through one at a time, and they all lead to the heavily reinforced checkout lane. And it looks like a little prison, a little rat maze. And it was a way of like training people how to shop for themselves. It also helps keep theft. You know, there's no place to hide in this structure. So as if they didn't trust people at the time to stand in line in an orderly manner or know how to use this grocery store. So they heavily enforced it through this tight maze of aisles that everybody would have to go in single file and go through all the lanes before they got to the checkout counter.
So, David, how do places with lots of lines choreograph them? You have some stuff here about Disneyland and how this is all controlled.
Yeah, so in the early part of the 20th century, a new field of study opened up, which is called queue theory, and it was started in basically to help with telephone traffic. You know, when people had switchboards and you didn't know when there's going to be a huge influx of callers, so they developed queue theory, which is a way of statistically, not guessing, but statistically finding out when there's going to be a higher traffic than other traffic. And so this started off this science of basically being able to predict crowds. And Disney is the one that has they're the state of the art for crowd technology. So they know what parts of the park the crowds are probably going to swell to at first. So they know how many rides to be, pushing through at any given time. Or they also have ways of basically making people not feel like they're waiting as long. So they'll have like entertainment within the lines. They have very interactive lines. They'll have games and they'll do things like project times that are slightly inflated so that when you get to the end of the line, you're actually pleasantly surprised by how short it was. And it's a mixture of science and being able to come to a reasonable guess about where crowds will swell first. And it's also about distracting people from the fact that they are waiting so that people aren't miserable at the same time.
Well, we certainly learn a lot in the book. It's called Why Does the Other Line Always Move Faster? The Myths and Misery, Secrets and Psychology of Waiting in Line. There's a lot in here in a fairly small book. David Andrews wrote it and joined us today in the exchange. David, thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, take it easy.